Today, we speak to a doctor treating COVID-19 patients at an intensive care unit in one of the worst hit parts of Britain.
It's Tuesday morning and I'm driving into work, and by my calculations I'll be driving back this way in about 26 hours.
This is Laura McClelland. She's a consultant anaesthetist in an intensive care unit at a busy South Wales hospital.
Morning.
It's an area with one of the highest rates of coronavirus cases across the UK, placing Laura and her colleagues on the front line of the worst health crisis to hit the world in a generation.
We are all dreaming about coronavirus. We are all lying in bed, going off to sleep, thinking of ways we can help our patients.
This week saw the highest spike in coronavirus deaths in a single day across the UK, including the first doctors and nurses. Too many health workers still do not have enough protective equipment or tests, meaning that hospitals are having to cope with up to a quarter of doctors remaining at home, despite many not knowing whether they've actually contracted COVID-19.
We cannot create a medical workforce overnight. We cannot go to a shop and buy doctors and nurses and ODPs and theatre staff, all of the people that we need to help us manage our massive surge influx of patients. So please help us so that we can help you stay away from each other, stay at home. This will not last forever.
From The Guardian, I'm Anushka Astana. Today in Focus, inside intensive care as the coronavirus crisis hits.
I'd always wanted to be a doctor, I think. That's certainly what my parents tell me. We were all involved in a very serious car accident in 1994. On a small French lane, we were driving a 2CV, one of those proper Coke can French cars. Some drunk blokes who'd been smoking a load of dope did 120 kilometres an hour on the wrong side, and my dad swerved and my mum just took the full impact and ended up with a motor on her legs, and she was trapped in the car for 3 hours. And I remember my mum being in ICU and her being at the complete mercy of the ICU physicians and the other multidisciplinary team, and seeing her in a state that you never want to see anybody you love in, and just realizing at the time that this was the absolute pinnacle of distress and grief and bargaining and this anticipatory horror, and just realizing the magnitude of the decisions that end up being made in ICU. And it's all thanks to them that she survived. I remember thinking that if I could ever help anybody in that situation like I'd been helped, then it was definitely a life well spent.
I mean, I'm kind of in awe of people like yourself, because it's an incredibly tough role. I spent 6 weeks in a family waiting room in ICU watching a loved one die when they had acute respiratory distress syndrome, so their lungs failed. And one of the things that struck me most sharply was how hard it must be for people like yourself and for the nurses caring for patients who are so desperately sick.
It's really hard. Different people have different ways of dealing with it. What I find actually is the hardest part is dealing with families, because often the patients aren't aware. They're often sedated or neurologically compromised, so that even if they appear to be aware, they don't necessarily subsequently have any recollection of what they've been through. But we get to spend a great deal of time with the families, and we make real bonds with them, particularly some of our patients who've been there for a couple of weeks or even a couple of months. And it's very difficult always being the person who makes someone cry when you know that you'll be remembered forever as the person who broke the bad news, or who told them things weren't getting better, or who said that we need to manage our expectations of what we realistically can achieve, for example. And it is difficult. And often I go to work and I realise that the only interactions I've had with families have been catastrophically tragic ones for them.
For what it's worth, Laura, although ICU doctors very much made me cry in that experience I was talking about, they are and they were the most important and heroic people to families like ours who are in that situation. What you do involves a huge amount of time talking to and reassuring families. That is a huge part of your role in normal situations, isn't it?
It absolutely is. And I'd say that that's one of the key areas of our workload, certainly. And I wouldn't have it any other way. Whether patients survive or whether they don't survive, the family have to go on into their futures. And the way that these situations are handled can have a really big impact on the way that they process everything. What's really, really difficult for me at the moment is the communication or lack thereof, having to have these conversations with people over the phone about their desperately ill loved ones. They feel completely at the mercy of a faceless stranger over the phone. I don't know what it's going to be like, but I've had a sniff of it already, and it's a real struggle.
Can you remember the first time you ever heard of coronavirus?
I do remember it was just, you know, something on BBC News, and it was just a couple of cases in China. And I remember the doctor speaking, saying that they'd had a few cases in the hospital that day, and they all seemed to be like the previous viral respiratory conditions we've encountered in the past 20 years. And I remember thinking to myself, if you've had a cluster of about 6 or 7 in one given day, they have been sneaking in for the past few weeks, but different people have seen them and they didn't join up the dots because maybe they only saw one. So that this thing has been going on for a lot longer than we probably think it's been going on for.
Do you remember when the first patient with the disease came to your hospital?
I do, because I was on call. A colleague and I just said, oh, it could be COVID, but it's unlikely, isn't it? And we sat there waiting for the swab results to come back. The patient was isolated, being treated as a query COVID, but neither of us thought that it was going to happen so soon to us. And lo and behold, it did.
So pretty quickly, I assume that one patient became several patients.
Yes.
How many coronavirus patients have you treated?
I've been involved in the care of probably 50 plus, maybe more. They've not all needed to come to intensive care and have been managed on the ward. Some of them, unfortunately, have died before we were able to provide the care that they may have benefited from earlier on in their disease process. So not everybody I see comes to intensive care, because there are other routes for patients to go down if it's not felt that they will benefit from intensive care or that they need it.
What sort of patients are you seeing coming into intensive care?
We've got young and old with us at the moment. I think, you know, we've got patients as young as in their 20s and patients as old as in their, I think, well, you admitted somebody who was a couple of months off being 80 the other day. What we are seeing within our cohort is a high prevalence of diabetes and hypertension and obesity.
Obesity.
This does not go for everybody. Yeah. So this, you know, I can only say what I see on a daily basis. And there certainly does seem to be a higher number of diabetics, people with high blood pressure, and people who are obese. Certainly within our patient population, obesity is common. I don't know if this is just a random kind of occurrence within our population or whether that actually is a thing, but it's certainly something that I am seeing myself. And we do have patients who are none of those things, but most of them have at least one of those things.
I want to ask you about personal protective equipment. I mean, there have been reports from NHS staff across the UK struggling to get enough PPE. There was one story about a doctor who literally had to borrow eye protection from his child's science party bag. What's your experience been of that? I mean, what protection have you got?
I personally have not had any problem getting the PPE that I need. I am not encountering the difficulties that other people have described, and most definitely not in intensive care. We're very, very well protected.
How much of a blow was it for you, for your colleagues, to hear about the first cases of doctors in the UK dying?
Well, it's awful. It's awfully sad news. I don't know the people in question, but I am fully aware that they could just as easily be my family members or my colleagues, or it could be me. And people who were self-sacrificing in doing what they thought was best for their patients has resulted in a tragedy. And it makes me realise quite how at risk we all are and what a duty we have to protect the people on the front line who may be most at risk. So we've got some diabetic doctors, we've got some hypertensive doctors, people with asthma, for example, people who are on immunosuppression for various conditions. And we do our best to keep them out of the firing line, really, even though we are all caught up in what we're doing, remembering to look after each other and to say to them sometimes, I know you want to help, but you have to look after yourself, because if you don't look after yourself, you'll never be able to help.
Have people on your team had the virus?
So I think last week there were only two of us out of the whole team who wasn't either in personal quarantine for coronavirus or in the 14-day period of isolation due to having a spouse or a child with coronavirus. And so there were only two of us last week who were able to really do any clinical work. People were doing stuff from home and were participating in meetings, but my colleague and myself largely had to provide all of the care for last week.
How are you managing with so much sickness? What does it mean for you?
It's an unprecedented time. We're doing 24-hour shifts now, which is fine. You know, it's not forever. Nobody would sign up to that on a regular basis with the intensity of the work that we're doing. But we all take our jobs very, very seriously and recognise that we have to pull it out of the bag. And we've got people who've come out of not doing so, people who've been intensive care consultants in the past who have given up intensive care and may not have done it for 8 years, 12 years, who are coming back.
What else have you been doing to prepare?
We've been speaking to the coroner to find out how they want us to document and alert them to various types of death from coronavirus. I've also been trying to put together kits so that we've got handprints of patients and Polaroid photos of patients and locks of hair, which can be kept in a locked room for several weeks so that the viral load eventually disperses, and when people are allowed back to hospital, they can collect those things so that they have something physical to remember their loved one by.
When intensive care starts to fill up with these cases, how will patient care change from how you usually look after people?
So I think we're going to need to manage expectations of what it is that we can do. But it may be that we are not in a position to concentrate on the finer points. So normally we're able to wean people from ventilators gradually by decreasing the amount of sedation they use so that they come around well, because cognitive dysfunction and delirium are very, very common in intensive care. So patients become agitated, they might hallucinate, they can become quite aggressive, or they can become withdrawn. And we may accept that that's not something we manage as well as we have managed it up until now. It is not going to be the same as much as we want it to be the same, which is why we've prepared so that we can highlight to people what the key areas are to focus on so that non-intensive care doctors can look after these patients. And there will be an intensive care consultant overseeing all of these doctors, and they will be reviewing these patients. But it's unavoidable that the one-to-one contact with the consultant and senior members of critical care is not going to be the same. And I need to emphasize that, because no, it's not going to be what we normally do, and it is absolutely not going to be perfect, and there will be problems, but it is the best we can do, and we are well prepared for that.
Are the patients who you're seeing scared when they come in?
Yeah, they are. I mean, yeah, they are scared, undeniably scared. And I don't know how to reassure them, because aside telling them that they're in good hands, that they're safe and we're going to do the very best that we can to look after them, I have no guarantees. I don't know what happens with this disease. I've not seen enough people come through it to tell them with any great conviction that I can predict this reasonably well. Certainly, I have to have lots of pretty brutal conversations with people on the ward who need to be fully aware of what it is intensive care represents and what it would represent to them. There are lots of tears, and the difficult part is that families aren't there with them.
You've said how one of the big changes has been how you deal with families. Just give me some examples of how you're coping with that at the moment.
So I've found it very difficult, actually. It's the thing that I've probably found the hardest up until now and will no doubt continue to find hard. You try to have honest conversations with them and say, look, this is the situation we're in. We are not making progress, or she or he has developed other problems, or I don't expect him or her to survive. And it's brutal coming from a phone, from a stranger. And I cannot underestimate what that must be like for families. And I'm not sure they understand how that is for us, because they presumably just think we do this all the time and that we're used to communicating with people like this, but we're not. This is all very new. And so we can offer to do video calling with people, but some people find that increasingly distressing because they have had it described to them, but then all of a sudden they're faced with a sedated, intubated loved one on a ventilator. They've never seen anything quite like it. It's very tough. On a couple of occasions, we've had families meet us in rooms off-site so that we can have face-to-face conversations, because some families have unrealistic expectations of what we can achieve, and they feel that the care is being rationed, which is not the case. Presently, we're doing everything that we normally would do, and I've been called shipman in the past couple of weeks, and another family member said only one thing worried them more than their relative not waking up, and it was that I was their doctor.
How does that make you feel?
Well, devastated. Absolutely devastated, because I don't normally, ordinarily, I don't struggle communicating with families. It's not something that it's not one of those things that is a general challenge for me on a daily basis. I tend to be able to communicate well with families. It's never been an issue before. People have said to me, you just want me to agree to let you do less with my family member because you just don't care and you can't be bothered, and all of these things that I understand why people feel that way. But when they're not there and they can't see what their loved one's going through, and when they can't speak to you and see you face to face and have a normal human interaction sitting in a relative's room and having a normal conversation where they can ask questions, where they can meet the nurses caring for their loved ones, I get why it is so bad for them and I get how they feel. But most people have been very understanding and have been absolutely great. And they just say, we realise you're all in a difficult position and please just continue to do the best and update us when you can.
And just to understand that, when somebody says Harold Shipman to you, a serial killer, what they think is that hospitals are somehow making decisions that means their loved one won't survive.
Yeah. And they don't really, they think it's, I think people think that we are having some kind of cull or some kind of, actually, do you know what, your loved one's too sick, they're not going to get a chance. That is not what's happening. People have pathologies, people have lots of other medical problems, people have untreatable conditions still, despite the fact there's a coronavirus pandemic and we can't do anything about them, and we wouldn't be able to do anything about them anyway.
Even with protective gear, you're putting yourself at risk. Are you worried about your family?
I'm not concerned about what would happen to my husband or I. We could be one of these people who's an outlier, who develops a very severe form of the disease. Statistically, that is unlikely. We're worried about our parents, and we don't see them. And I have no idea, as much as it pains me to say this, when I will see my parents again, or indeed if ever I will.
What are you doing to look after yourself at the moment?
Trying to exercise in the house, doing gardening, speaking to loved ones via FaceTime, and actually what does feel therapeutic is doing things that I know might make this a bit better in some way. My husband's a GP, trying to help my husband to sort out setting up a service for patients in his health authority, because it may make a difference. And actually sitting there not feeling like you can contribute is hard. And I've asked myself a lot over the past few weeks, what is worse at the moment, being able to help or not being able to help? Because if you weren't able to help, you wouldn't always be at risk. And you'd probably be paid for spending time at home with your family. It would be difficult and you'd be scared, but you'd be safe. Or being able to help and essentially being part of lots of people's grief, putting yourself at risk on a daily basis and never seeing your family really. But I always come back to the viewpoint that being able to help is an absolute privilege. And I will always be grateful for having been able to help.
We've seen huge support for the NHS. I mean, last week, people across the UK clapped, millions of people. I wonder if you could hear that clapping where you were, what it meant to you, and also what examples of kindness you've seen in your local community.
Oh, the examples of kindness and goodwill and the desire to help are so abundant. They are coming at us from all angles, and it's just lovely. I didn't hear the clapping. I was in A&E recess, but my mum did send me a video clip of everybody in their street clapping. I was fully aware of it, and I thought it was a completely lovely thing to do and totally uniting. And we've had local businesses who've given us clean pairs of socks. We've had drinks delivered. We've had thousands of Krispy Kreme donuts delivered. We've had Jamaican meals, takeaway curries, pizzas from Papa John's. I mean, you name it. If there's something we need, it arrives. People have loved the concept and the idea behind the NHS, but have been out of love with it for a while because it's under-resourced and people don't feel that it hasn't sometimes let them down on occasions. And I think that the love for the NHS has been very much regenerated and renewed, and the support out there to make sure that the NHS continues to thrive and deliver in these awful times is what is keeping everybody going.
Laura, thank you so much. And thank you and your colleagues for everything you're doing.
Oh, it's an absolute pleasure. And as I say, I know this sounds a bit cheesy, but it is an absolute honour.
That was Laura McClelland. Questions about whether the NHS is ready to cope with this crisis are still being asked in a week that saw a record number of deaths, including a 13-year-old boy. Do keep up with this story on our Guardian Live blog, and do listen to our Science Weekly podcasts, which are now coming out 3 times a week to cover this crisis. That's it for today. A huge thanks to Laura McClelland. This episode was produced by Elizabeth Cassin. Sound design was by Ian Chambers. The executive producers are Nicole Jackson and Phil Maynard. We'll be back tomorrow.